Good morning, Your Honors, and...
He's pouring a martini. Don't interrupt.
Thank you, Judge Bell.
Don't give our
Your Honor, this case is an interesting criminal case involving a real estate broker who supposedly, in a nutshell, engaged in a bribe and wire fraud by discussing splitting a commission with an Illinois broker to sell the state of Wisconsin's DOA building. The state of Wisconsin had decided that to meet its budget shortages.
Kind of oversimplified the conversation.
I Judge, we're trying to get into it here.
And didn't he use the term kickback when he was talking to...
No, he did not.
He never used the term?
No, he did not. The only time that he allegedly used it is in the unrecorded conversation with Mr. Silverstein, the Illinois broker who testified at trial.
And later. In his testimony, did he use that term?
There is testimony by Mr. Silverstein, unrecorded. The only one conversation that's not recorded.
Allegedly. There's sworn testimony.
Oh,
that he said
that's
that.
His. But he, that's his, yes, it's his testimony.
Convicted him so they believed him.
Well, it's interesting that it's the only unrecorded conversation, and Mr. Silverstein says that's the one he said.
Actually, a tremendous number of cases are resolved by unrecorded testimony. By
I agree.
Yes. Like 99% of them.
True. I thought that it might be helpful for all of us to... the reply brief, he has a copy of the matrix that this young real estate broker was utilizing, indicating all of the different variables. And that's the first page of the supplemental appendix to the reply brief. And although it strains my eyesight to see, it indicates just how complicated this transaction was and how varied the issues were that he was trying to boil down and get these 13 or so letter of intent people into line, not just on price, because we have price, term, square footage, parking structure, cap rate, early out, and he's trying to work with in all these parameters and creates this very interesting detailed spreadsheet that, according to the government, theory of the case was he could not discuss with the, shall we call them, competing letters of intent offerors their various variables.
And is this the one his rejected witness gave an A-plus on?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So this is excellent work as the former head of a state agency and the professor of real estate law at Marquette University. Professor Greenberg wanted to be here today, but he had open-heart surgery December 30th. And, yes, he said this is excellent work. This is what you want if you're a head of a state agency and you're going to try to sell a building or make a financial decision. And the other part of this case that's so interesting is that it was an open bid process, not closed bid. And Mr. Silverstein, who was the only other person testifying for the government side of the case, that this was an improper thing, said he thought it was a closed bid, a sealed bid situation. But it's uncontested that Mr. Matanowski, the DOA, Department of Administration, bureaucrat in charge, testified by stipulation with the government that this was an open bid situation. So in an open bid situation, you're much like an auctioneer if you are the realtor. And you are specifically allowed under Wisconsin law to take proposals in an open bid situation and disclose and present them, is the word in the Wisconsin law, present the competing proposals to the other member or proposal parties, I think they call them parties, and use that information to drive the prices up. And that's exactly what this man was doing. I don't know how the government can prevail on the theory that that was confidential information. Under Wisconsin law, that is also an open record because they did not use the form to make it a sealed bid.
I want to just focus on a couple of things. One is the expert witness.
Yes, sir.
You went through this long, I guess you'd call it voir dire or something, and
yes,
the court ultimately concluded that he could not use him as a witness. And then your client decided not to have a jury trial, and went on to the court trial, and he testified.
Yes.
Now, my question is, was he, would he have not had to testify if this expert witness had been allowed to?
That is my belief, Your Honor. He was required to testify as a real estate broker in his own defense because I was not allowed to present an expert to testify in a third-party status.
There was an offer of proof, wasn't there, sir?
Yes.
And the judge said that even with the offer of proof, he would have come to the same conclusion.
So he said.
So he said. And we have to believe him, don't we?
We do. And then that's why we're here, because he was in error on both of those decisions. The part of this case that I think is bigger than Mr. Lupton and really approaches the questions of federal jurisdiction is, at what point is this court going to allow its doors to be open to a federal criminal prosecution that is grounded totally on state law? There is a total violation of federalism here. This broker who has complied with all of the rules of the Wisconsin Department of Regulation and Licensing is acting in conformity with the statutes of the state of Wisconsin, I've developed that in my brief, is being now federally criminally charged, convicted of a felony bearing 20 years, when under the Wisconsin rules, if he were to have violated, he would have gotten a 6 months jail term and a $1,000 fine. Where does the federal government get its power, the executive branch of this government, to reach into Wisconsin state rules, use those rules to create a federal crime that has not ever been passed by Congress?
I'm a little curious.
Yes,
if this was so above board and in compliance with Wisconsin law, why didn't he tell the FBI agent what it was he was doing? Why did he give the FBI agent inaccurate information, I should say, about what he was doing?
Well, I can tell you that I was present during the second charging because I was in the proffer meeting, and I didn't hear any such things, but I can't testify to that. And there are no tape recordings of those, and there's no 302s on those. I can say that Mr. Honstad and I had a heated conversation about a crime being charged for me going to a proffer conference and discussing, and the reason that he's charged is he can't remember who said first that let's split the commission, which I say is a legal act anyway under Wisconsin law. But to be charged criminally for not remembering who said it first, now, and characterizing that as misleading the FBI, when they have the tape recorded recorded conversations themselves, and I've been asking him for about 6 weeks for them, and he won't give them to me until I have the proffer conference.
But this wouldn't have been one of the taped recordings. If this so-called alleged kickback statement was made in a non-recorded statement.
Which we did not know about until
so
trial.
There's not any recording that they are contradicting his testimony with.
No, on that
issue, at least, I guess.
I think that's right. It's a different issue because what they're saying that he lied to the FBI agent in count four of the indictment is that he denied that he is the one who brought up the topic of splitting the commission. I mean, Lupton denies he's the one who brought it up. He says, if it came up, I don't remember it. If you look at the testimony of the FBI agent, is Lupton couldn't remember that conversation, but if it did come up, it would have been Silverstein who brought it up first. And because he says that, he is now guilty of a crime. Not recalling who said it first, but if it did, it would have been Silverstein. And again, we don't have a recording of the first Silverstein conversation to know who brought it up first. We only have a second Silverstein conversation in which Silverstein coaxes his eye out of him and says, about that prior conversation, what is this we're talking about? So I'm actually much more concerned, though, about the fact that, especially after the Conrad Black oral argument, how it is that a federal prosecutor can use state court rules to create a federal crime that has not ever been passed by Congress, because that seems to violate all the way back to 1812 And all the way through, as I've addressed in my brief, Easterbrook, the judge, Chief Judge Easterbrook's opinion in Bloom, questioning of this, but never addressing it. And this case has generated a great flurry of controversy in Wisconsin. The brokerage community doesn't know what they can do and can't do, and I don't know how to answer the questions for them. They have a case where a person follows the rules. Now, if this court wants to substitute its judgment for the legislature of Wisconsin, I question the federalism of that. The state court statutes, or the state legislative statutes, specifically allow a broker to discuss splitting a commission and not disclose that fact to the principals. It's a specific exception to the disclosure requirement. And if the court wants me to, I can point that out. It's in my brief. But if we who now take our knowledge of fiduciary duties that we've learned and then look at the Wisconsin law where the statute says the common law is abrogated, it says that expressly. We have abrogated the common law duties of real estate brokers, and these are the new duties in this statute for brokers licensed in our state. Now, Mr. Honstead and the FBI agent did not check with the Wisconsin Department of Regulation and Licensing. I asked them on cross, did anyone do that? No, they didn't. And they didn't get anyone to testify from the real estate examining board. I put an expert forth who writes the questions for the real estate examining board out on the stand, and I'm told he can't testify. We're dipping into telling the Wisconsin state legislature how it can and can't license its professional real estate brokers, and we're the federal court, and we're the U.S. Attorney's Office, and we've never done a real estate transaction in our life, but we will tell you how to conduct yourself. Your rules be damned. And that violates federalism. It's an expansion area of view of federal criminal jurisdiction. It just doesn't stand up. And you can see from the briefs that if you carefully parse through the statute, the truth of even if you assume the facts true as the government side of it, he did not violate Wisconsin laws as a licensed broker.
Thank you.
I'll say the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Honstadt.
Morning. May it please the Court, Gregory Honstadt for the United States. The defendant challenges his conviction on each of these four counts and does so for a number of reasons. And at least at the outset, I plan to just go through count by count and address the defendant's arguments with respect to each of these counts. First, with respect to count one, the Section 666 violation, at least in his brief, his opening brief, the defendant first contends that he was not an agent for purposes of that statute. He points to two contracts in support of his position, principally the master contract between Equus and the state of Wisconsin, but also the transaction advisor agreement between the defendant, Larry Lupton, and Equus. And each of those documents provide that Equus employees and subcontractors are not to be considered agents. And the defendant takes from this that for purposes of Section 666, therefore, the defendant cannot be an agent. But the term agent for purposes of Section 666 is not one that is defined by private parties. Instead, the definition of agent is provided for in the statute itself in Section 666D1, which provides that an agent is a person who is authorized to act on behalf of another person or a government, and in the case of an organization or government, includes a servant or employee or representative. And the evidence at trial clearly established, or at least supported the district court's finding that under this definition, the defendant was an agent and was authorized to act on behalf of the Wisconsin Department of Administration in connection with its sale or proposed sale of the Wisconsin DOA building. In connection with that, the Department of Administration contracted with Equus for Equus to be the state's sole representative in connection with the sale of that building. Equus then assigned its vice president and independent contractor, Larry Lupton, to that sale. And in connection with his responsibilities on that sale, Mr. Lupton did a number of things. He sent out a detailed offering memorandum soliciting proposals from interested buyers. He developed and sent out a template or form letter of intent that, as he indicated, was intended to standardize the responses he got back on behalf of the state. He solicited letters of intent from interested parties and analyzed the letters of intent that were sent in. He compared them. He analyzed them. He eventually ranked them. And this is the matrix that Mr. Owens was talking about. He analyzed them, compared them, ranked them, and ultimately made a recommendation to the state as to which of those competing letters of intent were best suited to the state's purposes. Mr. Lupton also did a number of other things in connection with his responsibilities as the state's agent here. He negotiated with interested parties in an effort to get them, as he puts it, to drive up their prospective bids, to make better offers for the state. And in the end, he spoke for the state when telling these interested parties what terms, as a general matter, the state would find acceptable in this transaction. So given the broad language of Section 666, including its broad and relatively expansive definition of agent, and given the purposes of the statute, that is to protect the integrity of federal funds that are provided to state and local governments and agencies, a person with the duties and responsibilities that Mr. Lupton had clearly satisfies the term agent for purposes of 666. A person with such duties and responsibilities can, through the corrupt performance of those duties and responsibilities, divert funds away from the public good and toward his own private illicit gain. And for that reason, again, Mr. Lupton was an agent under Section 666, and the district court did not err in concluding so. Also, with respect to count one, the 666 violation, the defendant argues that the payment that he solicited was not in any way corrupt, but instead represented bona fide compensation that was to be paid in the normal course of business. More specifically, the defendant claims that the conversation that he was having with, or the conversations that he was having with Mr. Silverstein all revolved around the legitimate splitting of a commission or a fee. But there's no support for that characterization anywhere in the record other than from the self-serving testimony of Mr. Lupton himself. The evidence showed that Lupton solicited the payment from Silverstein in exchange for steering the sale to Silverstein and his client. There was never any indication of what it was that Mr. Lupton was going to do to earn this supposedly legitimate bona fide compensation other than to steer the contract to Mr. Silverstein and his client by feeding them competitors' proposal numbers.
Was that, they went through that, showed it, displayed this comprehensive thing that, whatever his expert's name was, it thought it was an A+, you know, that it at least went through all the motions of looking into this thing in a professional way. I'm just wondering if he came up with this person after the analysis as the top one or two, and then started to look into getting a part of the commission.
The matrix was an ongoing project. That is, as new proposals came in, the numbers were fed into the matrix, and it evolved. The numbers that Mr. Lupton fed to Mr. Silverstein came from a letter of intent that that Roebling Investments, one of the other competitors, sent to Mr. Lupton on April 30th. Mr. Lupton received that after having the recorded April 26th face-to-face meeting with Silverstein, and after hatching this plan during the unrecorded conversation on April 4th, again, received this letter of intent from Roebling Investments on April 30th, and then in another recorded conversation disclosed the precise details that were included in that letter of intent to Mr. Silverstein.
Now, Silverstein's recording these, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So he's already blown the whistle, so he's not implicated in any of this, even though he's sort of walking along with it.
No, that's right. He wasn't working with law enforcement at all when he was first approached in connection with this kickback on April 4th by Mr. Lupton. It was after that
April... That's when he alleged that this is when the kickback was raised.
That's correct. And it was after that conversation on April 4th where the term kickback was used that Mr. Lupton reported... that Mr. Silverstein reported this conversation to law enforcement. And then on April 26th, Mr. Lupton and Mr. Silverstein have their first recorded conversation, and that's in the face-to-face meeting. And that's the one where Mr. Lupton tells Mr. Silverstein what exactly it is that he can do for Silverstein and how he wants Silverstein to pay him and things of that nature. That, again, happens on April 26th. On April 27th, there's a recorded telephone conversation in which Mr. Lupton tells Mr. Silverstein, here are Roebling's numbers. It looks like this is the firm to beat, but I don't have them in writing yet. I'll let you know when I have them in writing. Again, that was on April 27th, which was a Friday. On the following Monday, April 30th, at 10:30 in the morning, there's another recorded call between Lupton and Silverstein where Lupton tells Silverstein, okay, now I've got them formally in writing, and here they are, just what I thought they were going to be based on the oral representations from last Friday. And also on that day, on April 30th, Mr. Lupton tells Mr. Silverstein, if anything else comes in by the end of the day, any other proposals come in by the end of the day that beat this, I'll let you know. And they have a conversation later that day about a proposal from a company called Arlen, where Mr. Lupton indicates he had received this proposal from Arlen. He was going to look it over and see what it looked like. He did so. He called Mr. Silverstein back and told him the numbers aren't going to fly. Roebling is still the firm to beat, so that if you submit numbers that are at least approach what Roebling submitted, I can go to bat for you and recommend to the state that you receive the sale contract.
Mr. Owens asserts that all of that information from the LOIs is public information. Is he right about that?
No. In fact, and he cites a number of state statutory provisions that he contends provide that those are all public. One of them is the open records law. But I want to make it clear that none of this prosecution, not even count two and the honest services component of wire fraud, is based solely on the defendant's violations of state law. In order to establish honest services fraud, the government has to establish misuse of office for private gain. So to the extent that things like contract provisions and state statutes indicate what is expected of parties in a transaction, they shed light on what appropriate behavior is and what might constitute misuse of office. But I think it's notable here that when Mr. Lupton was interviewed by the FBI, both on May 10th and May 18th, he never offered that explanation. He didn't say, yes, I disclosed competitor-specific bid details, and I did so because these were open records. Instead, he denied ever having disclosed specific bid details of competitors.
And regardless of whether the LOIs themselves are public record, is this matrix public record?
No.
This is used internally by the brokerage firm to analyze the various LOIs.
That's right, in connection with their making a recommendation to the state.
And the defendant here said, in addition to, even if you don't get the lowest or the best bid, I'll push for your guy.
That's right. He said he had to get him basically within striking distance, and if he did so by feeding him the top numbers, then he could go to bat for Mr. Silverstein's client and recommend that they get receive the contract. And also with respect to this notion of confidentiality, one of the state statutory provisions in the Wisconsin, in Chapter 452, provides that brokers have a duty to keep confidential information that parties expect to be confidential. And it doesn't get you too far necessarily on its face, but when you look at this particular transaction, the form or template letter of intent that Mr. Lupton himself prepared and sent out to these parties as kind of a go-by included a confidentiality provision. And when most of the prospective buyers, the letter of intent parties, sent their letter of intent back to Mr. Lupton, they also included a confidentiality provision. Notably, the Roebling letter of intent contained a confidentiality provision that was nearly identical to that included by Mr. Lupton when he sent out the form or template letter of intent. Getting back to this notion that this was what was not a kickback, but instead was a discussion about bona fide compensation paid in the normal course of business, undercutting that argument and undercutting the argument that this was a legitimate fee split discussion is the fact that, as Mr. Silverstein testified, in order to fee split, a writing is required. And in this case, not only was there no writing, regarding this fee split, but Mr. Lupton specifically and expressly told Mr. Silverstein that he didn't want anything in writing. And he didn't want anything in writing because he didn't want anything getting leaked back either to his employer, Equus, or to his client, the state of Wisconsin.
Wasn't there a discussion also about how it should be handled in cash and tax problems?
That's right. I think that also undercuts the notion that this was a legitimate compensation.
Part of a tape recording of the conversation?
It was part of the first April 26th face-to-face conversation. Mr. Lupton told Mr. Silverstein that he could either pay him in cash or by a check made payable not to him, not to Equus, but made payable to North American Commercial Opportunities, which was a defunct organization that Mr. Lupton had owned in the past. Mr. Lupton also suggested to Mr. Silverstein that he designate that particular payment as a consulting fee, not as a commission split or any other form of legitimate payment. Also, the transaction advisor agreement, that is the contract between Mr. Lupton and Equus Realty, provided for the appropriate flow of any legitimate fee payments that Mr. Lupton would receive. That particular contract provided that Mr. Lupton was to be compensated directly by Equus, not by third parties, and that in the event that he should receive a direct payment from a third party, that payment was to be disclosed at once to Equus. So, unlike the secret kickback that Lupton solicited from Silverstein, legitimate bona fide compensation would have gone through those ordinary channels. And if they had gone through those ordinary channels, Mr. Lupton's share of the commission would have been reduced because once it was disclosed or submitted to Equus, Equus would have done two things. They would have taken their share of the commission because in no event was Mr. Lupton entitled to 100% of any commission. It was split somewhere between 40-60 and 60-40 typically. And also, Equus would have taken out and counted part of Lupton's commission against the outstanding draw balance that he had, which at the time was around $27,000.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Owens, minutes.
Mr. Hanstead leaves out a very important fact that, in fact, the Roebling offer was the or not offer, letter of intent, was the one that was recommended by Mr. Lupton, not Mr. Silverstein's. In fact, Silverstein did not best the best, and the record indicates that Roebling, the one to beat, like an auctioneer, Lupton recommends not this supposed nefarious, but the highest one, Roebling. That's the fact. Natanowski, the DOA, says that's what he did. There's just no issue about that. And this idea that he has to put something in writing, the law in Wisconsin says that the prohibited conduct is acceptance of a fee or compensation from any person other than a broker's client, unless there's written consent. Acceptance. There was no fee ever. This is a conceptual discussion at the very beginning when Lupton says in the recording conversation, if the state of Wisconsin breaks its commission of 4.3% down to 1.75, are you willing to give me a quarter of a point of the commission? Now, that's a commission discussion. That's not a kickback. A quarter of a point of your commission. That's a commission split. It's not a kickback. It's not a shoebox of money. It's not a boat, a trip to Europe. It's a commission split, and that's completely allowed.
Why suggest a check payable to a defunct corporation rather than directly to him?
Because, well, first of all, NACO is an Illinois corporation. He had been a
Illinois. It doesn't make a difference. Why go through that subterfuge? If this is all on the square.
Because he is not an employee. That's another misstatement by the government. He's not an employee of Equus. He's an independent contractor. And this contract says he has to negotiate each commission structure with them as they go. And he's telling the guy from Illinois, if you want to pay it to the Illinois corporation that I used to have when I was an Illinois broker, we could maybe use that. But he's throwing out ideas. And I'm not convincing Judge Bauer, but that's the fact. I appreciate it. My time's up.
Great. Thank you. And this case will be taken under advisement.